is the Fox News Alerts. I'm Lisa Brady. At a mass prayer vigil in Dallas, police chief David Brown a short time ago.
We won't rest until we bring everyone involved to justice.
Calling the ambush that killed five officers, wounding seven more and two civilians, a well-planned evil tragedy. A gunman killed by police now believed to have been a U.S. veteran who had once deployed to Afghanistan. Fox Radio's Eben Brown with more live. He filed this just a short time ago.
A service record obtained by Fox News shows that Micah Xavier Johnson was an Army reservist, trained as a combat engineer, and rose to the enlisted grade of E3, or private first class. As an engineer, he likely would not have had any type of sniper training, but as a soldier, he would have had military training. The record shows Johnson deployed to Afghanistan back in 2013 and held several awards and ribbons. Police say he told them he was acting on his own behalf and specifically targeting white police officers.
Attorney General Loretta Lynch calling the Dallas ambush an unfathomable tragedy in a week of heartbreaking loss.
Now, after the events of this week, Americans across our country are feeling a sense of helplessness, of uncertainty, and of fear. And these feelings are understandable, and they are justified.
But she says violence is never the answer. Georgia Congressman and famed civil rights activist John Lewis.
We must learn to live together as brothers and sisters. If not, we will perish as fools.
Members of the Congressional Black Caucus also urging action on gun control.
Chicago has the most strict gun control laws in the country, and yet they lead the nation in gun violence.
Texas Republican Congressman Pete Sessions. Big rally on Wall Street right now. The Dow's up 225. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
The Republicans, the Democrats, two critical conventions, and only one network covers it all. Fair and balanced. Fox News Channel, starting July 18th, the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio. Then, starting July 25th, the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The must-see political events are on Fox News Channel. We are America's election headquarters.
Weeknight, Kelly brings the heat.
Developing tonight, a Kelly File exclusive. This is breaking news. We're just getting this.
Inside today's most explosive stories.
That's not the way it was supposed to go down.
Getting answers and challenging the status quo.
Sir, it's a back and forth. I'm not just going to give you the platform for a soliloquy. Don't come on here and spit. I will leave that to you to decide.
Powerful, insightful, fair, and balanced. Megyn Kelly taking prime time to the next degree.
Join me for the Kelly File, weeknights at 9.
10 states are now suing the federal government over new rules requiring public schools to allow transgender choice in bathrooms and locker rooms. Just getting word of the lawsuit filed in federal court in Nebraska. The other states involved are Arkansas, Kansas, Michigan, Montana, the Dakotas, South Carolina, Ohio, and Wyoming. Nebraska's attorney general arguing the U.S. Education Department and Justice Department are circumventing the process for changing existing laws. The White House has insisted no laws were changed in the president's recent directive. Stocks rallying over the new jobs report, 287,000 created in June.
The unemployment rate rose to 4.9% from 4.7% in May as people returned to the workforce, about 400,000 of them, but not all of them could find work.
Fox Business Network's Peter Barnes. A retired California priest is breaking new ground with every step he takes.
Patrick Tierney has some pep in his step.
I'm not giving it back. I like it so much, I'm keeping this thing.
That thing is Tierney's new prosthetic, a waterproof bionic ankle and foot.
The old foot was very stiff. There was no movement to it.
And the retired 76-year-old priest in Rancho Mirage, California, who lost his right leg in a car accident, is the first one to get it.
It's been the best thing that's happened to me in the 13 years that I've had a prosthetic.
It looks similar to a real foot.
Able to walk much better over inclines and stairs as a result of this technology.
Lee Carden at the Hanger Clinic says it constantly analyzes the terrain and has Bluetooth so users can customize it with their smartphones. Dave Anthony, Fox News.
Andy Murray is heading back to the men's final at Wimbledon, beating Czech player Tomáš Berdych moments ago in straight sets. Murray will face Canada's Miloš Raonic, who upset Roger Federer earlier today to reach his first ever Grand Slam final. I'm Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. It's a Friday, hot outside, and hope you're having a great day with a nice weekend lined up. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the law enforcement officers in Dallas who lost their lives last night in a terrific, horrific tragedy. Just really no words to describe the horror and senselessness of that act. We certainly have our thoughts and prayers going out to the individuals who were lost their lives earlier in the week in Louisiana and Minnesota, but last night was just a real wake-up call that things are not as they should be in our country, and we need to realize that. Our guest, before we get to our guest, Chuck Stuber, I'd like to tell you that if you'd like to call us, you may do so at 919-747-9421. You can hook us up on Twitter, at What Matters NC, or you can tweet at me, at Mark Shiver. We'd love to hear from you, and we have a big show for you today. Lots going on, but just really somber starting out today because what happened last night in Dallas was certainly tragic, and I would encourage you to say a prayer for the families of the law enforcement officials who were basically just shot for no reason whatsoever. And often that is the case. I mean, people get shot for a variety of reasons, but for someone to just take aim because they were law enforcement or because of the color of their skin, it really is tragic. But again, please pray for the families. Well, kicking us off today, Charles Chuck Stuber, former FBI special agent, current candidate for state auditor. He's also worked as a chief investigator with the State Board of Elections. Chuck, welcome to What Matters in North Carolina.
Thanks, Mark. Thank you for having me on your show.
Well, if you were in the FBI today and something like what happened in Dallas last night had happened, what would you guys be doing? Anything, or would you be doing anything different than what you would normally do?
Well, I know everybody, I know I was horrified, and I feel the pain as a 30-year approximately law enforcement officer myself. Every time I see something like this, it just breaks my heart, especially, you know, I read about some of the victims. One had just gotten married to another officer, another had a small child, and, you know, you just really hate to see something like this. And what we would often do, too, is we would put a piece of black tape over our badges to signify our support for the law enforcement community and the officers that were victimized by this senseless, unconscionable act. And I can tell you right now, I mean, I feel a pall over me, and I'm sure every law enforcement agency across the country is saddened by this, and it's, you know, a hard thing to have to deal with. And law enforcement officers, you know, regardless of, you know, your opinion of certain things that would have happened, in my experience in law enforcement, 99% of the officers are extremely dedicated public servants who put their lives on the line every day to protect our citizens and you know, work extremely hard to make that happen. And something like this is just, as I say, beyond belief.
Our guest is Chuck Stuber here on What Matters in North Carolina. When you were in the FBI, obviously, I guess every law enforcement officer realizes there's risk and danger involved, but I guess you never walk around thinking in your mind that somebody's just going to start shooting randomly at law enforcement people.
Exactly. That's I know in the FBI, one of the advantages we had was we weren't generally wearing a uniform, you know, unless we were doing a special operation. So we weren't easy targets for people to necessarily know who we were, but the officers, you know, police officers, many of them wear a uniform every day, and they're out there, and people that have bad intentions can do things like the shooters yesterday. And as you say, you know, it was just completely random. These officers had done nothing to deserve or to deserve something like that happening to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Wanted to ask you, you were with the State Board of Elections for quite some time as their chief investigator. In terms of like what we heard this week with Senator Fletcher Hartzell, what, I mean, you could look at just about any candidate and say, well, that's interesting, at least, you know, to some degree. But what was it about his situation compared to others that, from what you've heard, I know you weren't involved in the investigation, but what makes the Board of Elections really raise an eyebrow when they look at a candidate's report?
Right. Well, let me say this. First of all, I had involvement with the Fletcher Hartzell case, both with the FBI and then at the Board of Elections, so I really can't speak to that case.
Okay.
Because I could conceivably be called as a witness in a court proceeding, so I really can't speak to that particular case. But I do know in one of the things that the Board of Elections looks at when it involves campaign finances is whether or not the expense incurred by the campaign or paid for by the campaign was something that the person would have had, whether they were a public official or not. Like, for instance, and it varies case to case. For instance, if you're, say, from a farmer from rural North Carolina and don't own a suit, well, you're required to wear a suit on the floor of the legislature, so buying a suit might be a legitimate campaign expense. If you're a lawyer and you go to court every day and you own a bunch of suits, buying a suit would not probably be considered to be a legitimate campaign expense. They're sort of a but for your service in the legislature or as a candidate, you would not have that expense. That's kind of the rule of thumb there.
Well, it's all very interesting, and I guess that there really is a somewhat of a gray area when it comes to, you know, applying. In other words, there's not a lot of rule book that says, you know, no suits or no dinners over $12. You know what I mean? So there's some discretion there. Our guest is Chuck Stuber, who is formerly with the FBI and with the State Board of Elections as a chief investigator, now Republican candidate for state auditor. And before we get to what you see as some of the needs in our state that have prompted you to run for the auditor position, the FBI was front and center on everybody's radar over the last few days, at least until this tragedy last night in Dallas. And Director Comey basically sounded to me like he was talking out of both sides of his mouth. Yeah, she did this and that, but it's all good. Can you talk about him letting Hillary slide and what your thoughts were about all that?
Okay, well, I've been asked the question probably 500 times since I started to run for office, you know, what's going to happen to Hillary? And I can say this. Well, let me preface my comments first by saying that I have the highest regard for the FBI. I was a special agent with the FBI for 28 years. I'm very proud of my career. And as I said when I described the other law enforcement officers, the people in the FBI are extremely dedicated, hardworking professionals that do things, by the Constitution and do an excellent job in their investigations. And I have a very high regard for Director Comey. I've only met him on one occasion, but from what I've heard and read about him, he sounds like an excellent director. Now, with that said, I will say that I was somewhat surprised when I saw the FBI, report that Director Comey gave, and not so much because of the fact that it stated that he didn't think Hillary Clinton should be indicted, but more so because the FBI generally does not engage in advocacy as far as, you know, whether someone gets prosecuted or not. The FBI's job is to investigate in an unbiased, independent way, develop the facts of the case, the evidence, basically find the truth of what happened. And then at that point, generally what happens is the FBI will take the, if they've done reports or the evidence of the investigation to whether it's the U.S. Attorney's Office or in this case, the Department of Justice, and then they will probably have input in how the Department of Justice evaluates the evidence, but the Department of Justice makes the final decision. The FBI does not indict people. I've had people ask me many times, is the FBI going to indict Hillary? Well, the FBI doesn't indict people, the FBI investigates. That's what the I in FBI stands for. And prosecuting attorneys make the charging decisions. So I was surprised to see Director Comey come forward with some sort of recommendation as far as the charges were concerned. I would have expected that he would have taken the evidence and the agents that worked on the case, taken the evidence to the Department of Justice, discussed it with the DOJ attorneys, and probably in this case it would have gone all the way up to the Attorney General of the United States, Loretta Lynch, who would have had to make the decision, and that the decision would have been made then by the Department of Justice, and they would have made an announcement. I thought it was a little unusual that the FBI came out with a release like Director Comey did.
Well, yeah, it was certainly, I was cynical the whole time. I think that had anyone asked me what's going to happen to Hillary, I would have immediately said nothing, because the history of her and her husband has been that of being completely immune, and Teflon is what I call them. Nothing sticks, and it's amazing because their entire political history, they have seemed to be able to avoid any kind of challenges when it comes to legality or, you know, really close scrutiny. And no matter what they do or what they're accused of doing, people still love them and vote for them. And it's quite an amazing thing as far as I can see.
Right. And I will say, again, people had asked me many times what I expected to happen. And generally what I would tell them is that I felt like that if nothing had happened at this stage, there wasn't going to be an indictment or anything this close to the election, and especially with a Democratic attorney general, Democratic president, that, and obviously the Attorney General of the United States would have to weigh in on this case. But I know when I was with the FBI, we were involved in the John Edwards case, and there was a big concern because we got the allegations in August of 2008, and the election obviously was in November of 2008, and there was a big concern about us not doing anything overtly that would somehow or another taint the election process. And so I would have been very surprised if Hillary had been indicted, you know, so soon with the election so close down the road.
But doesn't that send a message to regular folk that, yeah, she's special, or folks in politics are somehow special and they're above the law?
Well, you could certainly interpret it that way. and I know I've been asked the question, you know, what would happen to you if you had, you know, done something like this as an FBI agent? And I would imagine it would have caused some major problems for me. Probably would have lost my job. And, you know, again, I would have been very concerned about the possibility of being prosecuted.
Yeah. Our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina is Chuck Stuber, and he was with the FBI for quite some time and the State Board of Elections as a chief investigator. Now he's running for state auditor. And what made you toss your hat into that ring?
Well, it's something that I felt called to do. I certainly thought about it and prayed about it a lot. And I really, my entire career has been one of public service, especially in the FBI. I was involved in, as far as my background goes for the auditor position, I've been involved in all sorts of complex white collar crime cases, from $300 million Ponzi schemes to government fraud cases, mortgage fraud, investment securities fraud, healthcare fraud, and then obviously a number of corruption cases. I was a case agent on the Jim Black case here in North Carolina, the Frank Balance case, the Michael Decker case, the Mike Easley case, the John Edwards case, and several others. And I just felt like my background doing complex, high-profile investigations like those prepared me very well to do what the state auditor is tasked with doing, which is overseeing how your tax dollars are spent, being a watchdog to make sure your tax dollars aren't being misused, and then obviously looking for fraud, waste, abuse, corruption, and, you know, being able to do something about it. And I, one of the things I really loved about my career in the FBI was I felt like I could see a problem. You know, if I saw something that didn't look right, whether it was somebody perpetrating an investment fraud scheme or somebody scamming the government in a fraud scheme, or even, you know, a drug dealer selling drugs to young kids, or a corrupt public official, I could look at what was going on, and I didn't have to just be satisfied with you know, writing a letter to the newspaper or something like that. I could actually go out and do something about it. I could open a case. I could gather evidence, do an investigation, and if we found that there was criminal activity going on, we could take the case to the U.S. Attorney's Office, probably take the case to a grand jury, get an indictment, arrest the person, and if there was money lost, there were forfeiture laws where we could try to help people get their money back or recover money that had been stolen. And I really felt like, you know, I was able to do a lot of good for a lot of people. I always enjoyed coming to work. I always felt good looking at myself in the mirror, feeling like I was doing a great service for the citizens of our country and citizens of North Carolina when I got back to North Carolina. And I really feel like the state auditor's office is an area where I could really use my talents and experience to do the same sort of thing. I feel like we've got a real serious problem with fraud and wasteful spending, and, you know, that there's a very large percentage of our budget that gets wasted or stolen or misused. And the state auditor has the ability to go in and conduct an audit when they see an area that looks like, you know, some money is not being spent the right way. They have the authority to conduct an audit to look for fraud or wasteful spending. And if they find it, and then be able to do something about it. And that's what I look forward to being able to do in that capacity. And I really feel like my background, I know when I was with the FBI, cases didn't just walk in the door. You couldn't just sit by the phone. You had to, you know, actually take a proactive approach to go look for areas where, if it was corruption or if it was, you know, somebody committing white collar crime. I mean, that corrupt acts don't happen out in the open. You know, you had to take a proactive approach to find those kinds of cases, and then to, you know, you had to be creative to investigate those cases, and especially the cases against high profile public officials. You were up against a lot of obstacles because a lot of times people didn't want to cooperate with you because they were scared of the person. They were resistant to your efforts to investigate the cases. You were up against high-powered defense attorneys that would defend these individuals in court, and you know, you had a very high standard of having to take these cases to court and prove them beyond a reasonable doubt, which it's never been quantified by the courts, but, you know, right, it's probably 97-98%. So you've got to be almost 100% right, and I've been able to do that and secure convictions against a number of these individuals, many of whom pled guilty when faced with the criminal charges. And I just feel like that gives me an exceptional background to be the state auditor and to take the auditor's office to a higher level in finding fraud and wasteful spending and corruption.
Yeah, well, our guest is candidate for state auditor, Republican candidate Chuck Stuber, and lengthy career in the FBI and with the State Board of Elections as a chief investigator. And auditor is not a very, you know, it's not a position that we're going to see hundreds and hundreds of campaign ads like senator or for president. How do you get people to care about the position of auditor?
Well, I can tell you this. I consider it to be one of the most important positions in state government. And the way I explain it to people is I ask, if you pay taxes, you know, do you pay taxes? If you pay taxes, if you're a taxpaying citizen, you should be concerned about who the state auditor is, because the state auditor looks after how your tax dollars are spent. And I know have to pay my taxes. I don't enjoy it, but, yeah, you know, at least I want to know that my tax dollars are being used the right way, and that, you know, they're not being lost. They're being used for education and healthcare, all the important things that we need our government services to provide, and that they're not, again, being lost or wasted or stolen. And I really do feel it's a again, an extremely important position. As you say, you know, a lot of people don't seem to know much about the office, but, you know, if I'm elected, I'm very hopeful that we'll be doing some really good work that'll catch people's attention, that, more people will know about the state auditor, down the line. If I can have 4 years in the job, I think I can really, make some good things happen.
Well, we appreciate having the opportunity to chat with you today about not only the auditor's position and why that is important, but also your thoughts on the FBI and Hillary, and also on the tragedy in Dallas last night. Chuck Stuber, thank you very much for joining us. We look forward to talking to you again soon here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. And let me just mention one other thing, if you don't mind.
Sure.
We have a website. It's www.chuckstuber.com. And I would encourage people, as you say, there's not a whole lot of advertising going on about the auditor's race, but people can go to our website. We've got a lot of information about my career in the FBI and my qualifications for the state auditor position. There's a two-minute video up there. If all you have are 2 minutes, take a look at it. And I would encourage people to check that out. I hope the citizens will give me strong consideration.
And that is chuckstuber.com.
Yes, sir.
All right. Well, we'll definitely send people that way. Well, thank you, sir. And we'll look forward to having you again on the program again real soon. And in terms of, we've got a couple of minutes here before the news break. So I just wanted to mention this thing again in Dallas. And thanks again for Chuck Stuber for joining us. But this thing in Dallas, it was really just unbelievable. And, you know, you have a Black Lives Matter protest going on, and somebody just decides to fire away. They're saying the guy's name is Micah Johnson, and apparently has said that he wanted to kill some folks, and I guess some white folks, from what I've seen online. But this is just unbelievable. His sister, defending his actions on social media, saying, according to one report, that cops needed to get a taste of the life we now fear. And this was Nicole Johnson on Facebook. And you know, I don't think anybody sits around whenever you have a law enforcement officer involved shooting and, you know, says this kind of thing. I don't think that people are, you know, saying things like, well, this person's getting a taste or something like that. I mean, people aren't just wired that way. And yet here is the sibling of Micah Johnson and Nicole Johnson. And, you know, law enforcement's getting a taste. Cops need to get a taste. And that's just, I just don't even understand how people are wired that way. You know, I just don't get it. I just do not get it. And you can feel that way. I guess you can have a feeling that the police are wrong and that they're out to get you and all of that. But to say, you know, they're getting a taste of what we fear. I mean, you just don't gun down policemen. You just don't gun down cops. I don't think you do. Anyway, you're listening to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. We're going to break for the news, come back and talk to John Wins, and we'll look forward to that. You're on the Freedom Action Network. We'll be right back.
Fox News Alert, I'm Lisa Brady. The mayor of Dallas says it's time for a change in attitude.
An attitude of humility, of gratitude, that this square was built on.
Mayor Mike Rawlings at a prayer vigil in Thanksgiving Square. Police say a gunman who ambushed officers told them he wanted to kill white people. Turns out he had served in the U.S. military. Fox Radio's Eben Brown with more live.
Elisa, also at that same prayer vigil, the police chief in Dallas, David Brown.
But we are determined to not let this person steal this democracy from us.
Now, this person being the now deceased shooter, Micah Xavier Johnson, he was 25 and from the Dallas area. He had also served in the U.S. Army in the reserves as a combat engineer, even deployed to Afghanistan from late 2013 to summer of 2014, Lisa.
Well, Eben, the White House says no links to any terrorist organizations have been found in the attack that killed five officers, wounding seven more and two civilians. President Obama ordering flags. Fox News Alert, I'm Lisa Brady. The mayor of Dallas says it's time for a change in attitude.
An attitude of humility, of gratitude that this square was built on.
Mayor Mike Rawlings at a prayer vigil in Thanksgiving Square. Police say a gunman who ambushed officers told them he wanted to kill white people. Turns out he had served in the U.S. military. Fox Radio's Eben Brown with more live.
Elisa, also at that same prayer vigil, the police chief in Dallas, David Brown.
But we are determined to not let this person steal this democracy from us.
Now, this person being the now deceased shooter, Micah Xavier Johnson, he was 25 and from the Dallas area. He had also served in the U.S. Army in the reserves as a combat engineer, even deployed to Afghanistan from late 2013 to summer of 2014, Lisa.
Well, Eben, the White House says no links to any terrorist organizations have been found in the attack that killed five officers, wounding seven more and two civilians. President Obama ordering flags at half-staff after condemning the ambush as despicable during a NATO summit in Poland. Attorney General Loretta Lynch.
To all Americans, I ask you, I implore you, do not let this week precipitate a new normal in this country. I ask you to turn to each other, not against each other, as we move forward.
Lynch offering condolences for Dallas and to the families of the two black men shot and killed by police in Louisiana and Minnesota this week. Investigators in Tennessee now say the man who opened fire at a Days Inn yesterday, also targeting cars on a nearby highway, was troubled by recent police shootings. The suspect remains hospitalized, shot as arriving officers returned fire. An officer is one of three others wounded. That attack killed a newspaper carrier. An hour to the close on Wall Street, the Dow up 254. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Real experience, real insight.
We're following this explosive story.
Nothing gets by Greta. Then.
This is all BS. What was that all about?
There's no spin and no question. O'Reilly dominates. Plus, smart, sharp, and cutting edge.
It's the news of the day, but with a little heat.
Megan delivers. And Sean seals the deal with fearless talk.
What part of that are you understanding?
Most watched. Most trusted. Fox News Channel.
There's more to Fox News Radio than meets the ear. Go behind the headlines and join the conversation on the hottest stories of the day on the Fox News Radio Facebook page. Be a part of the Fox News Radio Facebook fan community. Post comments and tell us your opinions. See behind-the-scenes photos and videos and post your reactions to the stories that matter to you. Click the like button on Facebook and connect with breaking news and features like Fox in the Fast Lane, House Call for Help, and more. Go to Facebook.com/Fox News Radio.
A suspect in custody for deadly attacks on the homeless in San Diego. Fox Radio's Jessica Rosenthal has this live.
Lisa, San Diego police arrested a 36-year-old man for murdering two homeless people and injuring two others.
My name is Anthony Padgett. We are innocent.
But a man with the same name, whose age matches, was convicted 6 years ago of attacking a homeless acquaintance and setting him on fire. Of the two homeless men killed and two injured just this past week, two of them were also set on fire as well.
We're going to still consider those other attacks that have been happening over the past few weeks. We need to determine if Mr. Padgett is involved or if we either still have another suspect out there.
And Captain David Nislight says they still have a lot of work to do, witnesses to even locate and evidence to process in this case, Lisa.
Thanks, Jessica. A new federal lawsuit by 10 states against the federal government over the president's recent directive to public schools to allow transgender choice in bathrooms and locker rooms. Some pro sports leagues might soon get more social.
Twitter is in talks with several pro leagues and broadcasters about streaming live sports. According to tech website Recode, the NBA, Major League Soccer, and Turner, the parent company of TNT, are among those the social media platform is negotiating with in its bid to acquire digital content rights. Twitter already has a deal with the NFL, paying $10 million last year to live stream some Thursday night games. The company is also reportedly exploring fringe coverage, like it has done with Wimbledon this year, providing pre- and post-match material, while another company has the actual match streaming rights. Chris Onig, Fox News.
Recapping the big rally underway on Wall Street, the Dow is up 250 points, topping 18,100. It's at pre-Brexit levels. Oil prices inching higher, but still near $45 a barrel. It's a rally over the June jobs report. More jobs than expected created, 287,000. Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
We are back here on What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to us as we are live from 3 to 5 every Monday through Friday, bringing you the latest in things that really are important in North Carolina. And, of course, our hearts, thoughts, and prayers are going out to the families of the law enforcement officers who were gunned down last night in Dallas. And a very tragic event indeed. And hopefully, well, I don't know if you can ever make any sense out of something like that, but maybe perhaps the days and weeks to come will shed some light. One of the things that we love to do is to talk to people on the show, particularly during an election season like the one that we are in, about North Carolina and the influence the state might have in the upcoming presidential election. I was intrigued to read John Wynn wrote a piece entitled Clinton's Carolina Strategy at Politics NC, and John is with us now. Welcome to the program, sir.
Good to be here.
So you make the assertion in your piece that perhaps North Carolina is not a state that is a must-have for Hillary to win.
It's certainly not a state that she needs. A state that she needs is probably somewhere like Virginia, Colorado, Ohio. North Carolina is a little bit to the right of the nation as a whole. And so if Clinton is competing here, that means that she's got the advantage overall.
Our guest is John Wynn, talking about Clinton's Carolina strategy. Now, not to contradict what you're saying, but there are a lot of people who have written in mass that North Carolina is a key state and it's important and it's growing in importance. And but you would say that that's not necessarily the case.
I would say not at this point. Perhaps in an election cycle or two, we'll be right at the median. We're still a little bit more to the right as a whole.
So in your article, you mentioned that her coming here twice now within a month is really kind of a deflection strategy, causing the Trump campaign to focus on North Carolina when they might should be focusing elsewhere.
It's a sign of confidence in the Clinton campaign. It's a sign that they know that they're ahead and they're trying to expand in a territory that they might not necessarily win an even election. So she's playing offense.
Our guest is John Wynn. You can find his writing at Politics NC. Now, John, I know that you do some polling analysis, and we've had several guests on the program that have said because the negatives are so high for both candidates that it's difficult to accurately poll as it may have been compared to previous presidential elections. Would you agree with that?
I'd agree to a certain point. I think there's a lot of undecided voters. It's really, you know, who do you dislike least at this point? Whereas in other contests, it's more of a matter of, you know, who do you like more? So that could mean more undecideds and more people who are unsure or softly supporting their candidate.
If you were in Donald Trump's inner circle, what advice would you give him? Is there anything he can do between now and November, still several months away, to overtake what seems to be a strong Clinton position at this point?
I would tell him to stay on message. And I think that's probably his biggest issue so far, is that sometimes the news cycle is pretty much given to him, but he doesn't take advantage of it. And he gets distracted with other things. So I would say to him, you know, stay on message, stay the course, and don't do anything stupid.
Well, he's sort of already broken that rule, John, several times, I think. But in so doing, that may have been part of his appeal. I have said for some time now that his appeal in the Republican primary, anyway, has been because many voters are just fed up with the status quo and the establishment and politics as usual. I think we also saw that in those who came out and supported Bernie Sanders, even though it wasn't enough to overtake Hillary on the Democratic side in their primary. Would you, is there any way he can translate or at least move that success that he had in tapping into that anger and that frustration that people feel with the establishment, not only to enough Republicans to win the primary, but also nationally to try to win the White House?
I think he definitely can, and that's why it's important that he needs to stay on message. I think that he is underperforming sort of the appeal that a outsider campaign like his should have. So I think he needs to stay on message, and I think you'll see him expand his appeal if he can run more of a conventional kind of campaign.
Do you think it's possible for him to do that?
Not really.
He's definitely broken all the rules so far. Do you? We're talking with John Wynn. You can read his work at politicsnc.com. Do you think there's been some talk about Newt Gingrich as a vice president? I think my first reaction was that's absurd, but there are smarter people than me making these decisions. What do you think?
I think Newt Gingrich is certainly probably at the top of the list, one of the few people at the top of the list. Trump and Gingrich have chemistry together, and they also sort of match each other politically. You know, Gingrich is known for going after the media. Trump is known for going after the media. Apparently, Trump likes what he sees in Gingrich. So I would not be at all surprised if he was chosen as the vice presidential candidate.
But doesn't traditional thinking normally say, let's get a vice presidential candidate who can bring us a lot of electoral votes? I mean, Gingrich, and also, you know, this whole thing about Hillary's a woman, first female president. I was thinking it might be smart if there were a strong female that he could pair up with to offset that. What are your thoughts there?
Well, there are several female candidates who I think are in the running. There's the governor of Oklahoma, Mary Fallon. There's also Marsha Blackburn, who is a congresswoman from Tennessee. I think either of those would be strong picks. He definitely needs to win over women, and I think a female running mate would be a good tack for doing that.
Well, John, we appreciate your time and visiting with us here on What Matters in North Carolina, and keep up the work. Your writing at Politics NC is always very good, and we appreciate it.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
All right. John Wynn from Politics NC, and his Clinton's Carolina strategy, saying his assertion is that she doesn't need North Carolina. She's coming here basically to make the Trump campaign pay attention to North Carolina when she's already got it in the bag, making the Trump campaign spend money here that otherwise they should be spending somewhere else. An interesting view, and it was good to talk with John Wynn here on What Matters in North Carolina. As we move along through the program, I want to talk a little bit about North Carolina, because some people would disagree with Mr. Wynn in that North Carolina may be more important than what he has said in his article that we were talking about. NBC News, big headline, rapidly changing North Carolina, becoming a key swing state. And so there is more and more importance being placed on North Carolina as a state that a presidential candidate cannot ignore. Now, obviously, Florida and Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, California, Texas, those are states with, you know, bags full of electoral votes. But North Carolina, I think, is growing, at least, in importance when it comes to the presidential elections. And the importance of the state, I don't think, can be underestimated. Now, there are other, byproducts, or not byproducts, but effects that will be felt from the presidential election throughout the other races, some very key races. As you know, in North Carolina, the Governor McCrory versus the Attorney General, at least in name, Roy Cooper. You also have Richard Burr and Deborah Ross. Richard Burr, the incumbent United States Senator. Deborah Ross, formerly in the General Assembly as a senator on the Democratic side, and she is challenging Richard Burr. Dale Falwell, who was a member of the House of Representatives and has vast experience in the Department of Employment Security, turned that place around, and we have paid off a $2 billion debt to the federal government and socked away $1 billion in the unemployment reserve fund. And this has enabled businesses to see a great reduction in the amount of money that they have to have taken out of their checks. Governor McCrory said under the leadership of Dale Falwell, actually he said the genius of Dale Falwell, they really turned that division around. He's running for the office of state treasurer, has said, and many people have talked about how there is a great concern in North Carolina over the unfunded pension liabilities that we have and obligations that the state has to retirees by way not only of their retirement income, but also medical benefits. And so Dale Falwell sees a situation there that, frankly, he might be able to help and do the things there that he did at the Employment Security Commission. His opponent is Dan Blue III, son of Senator Dan Blue, who serves in the General Assembly representing Wake County. And he's also running for the office of state treasurer. And there's just a lot of very important elections this time around. Buck Newton, senator, representing Wilson and Johnston County against former Wake County Senator Josh Stein, running for attorney general. And that should be a very compelling race as well. So there's a lot of races. Auditor Beth Wood running against a guest we just had a few minutes ago, Republican Chuck Stuber. And the list goes on and on. So the important thing, as I was mentioning yesterday, is to get involved and to participate in the process. Your active participation really is important. It's important that you go to the polls. It's important that you vote. It's important that you get out and make known your feelings to those who are in public office and may or may not be doing the things that you agree with. If they are, you know, a nice letter or email or note or call of appreciation goes a long way. But also, if they're not, well, let them know about it. You know, pick up the phone or just fire them off an email. Now, these guys get thousands and thousands of emails in Congress, not as much locally in the General Assembly. But I will tell you this, that at least when I worked at the General Assembly, most of the members down there do take constituent contact pretty seriously. Now, if you live in Rocky Mount and you're emailing a state representative in Asheville, it's not very likely that they're going to be as concerned as if you lived in Asheville because you're not in their district. But you can certainly contact and make known the way that you feel, good or bad, to the people that represent you in your district. And it's easy to find out who those people are. You can go to the General Assembly website, ncleg.net, and it says, who represents me? And you can put your information in there and let people know, you know, hey, I disagree with the way you voted, or I agreed with the way you handled this. I appreciate you putting this legislation out there. Whatever it is, get involved and let the people that represent you know that you're watching, you're paying attention, and that you expect them to represent you. So many times, I think, particularly in Congress, those guys and ladies up there, they forget. They absolutely forget who put them there, that they were voted and elected to serve their constituency. And they would tell you, well, I have a great staff to help people with constituent service. But the problem is they get on the floor of the House or the Senate and they just totally forget who they are and where they're from. I mean, we saw Renee Elmers. She voted multiple times, totally in contradiction to people that had supported her and really got her elected. And so, you know, she basically said, hey, I don't care, to those people. And, well, guess what? Those very same people, she rode around on an Americans for Prosperity bus, I guess 6 years ago, whenever it was. And those same people, Americans for Prosperity, campaigned against her because she basically forgot how she got to where she was. And I think we're going to see more of this in the near future. We're going to see people finally say, look, you know, we sent you to Washington or we sent you to Raleigh, and you've just totally abandoned whatever principles you said that you had, which caused us to vote for you. And, you know, we're going to hold you accountable. We are going to hold you accountable. And all of a sudden, maybe we'll start getting the attention of some of elected officials. Like yesterday, I was talking about Glenn McConnell. I mean, his budget shenanigans are just horrendous. You know, allowing committee votes where Republicans vote for Democrat or vote with Democrats, $500 million to support Obama's green energy thing with the United Nations. That's taxpayer money to support Planned Parenthood's initiative with the United Nations in population, whatever it is. It's translated abortion. So tax money, your tax money. And here are Republicans voting like crazy for these things. They have forgotten who sent them there. They have forgotten who they represent. And if they are not careful, people are going to wise up and wake up and say, you know what, bud? I think we've had just about enough, and we'll just put somebody else in your seat and see how they do. The problem is these guys in Congress, especially to a certain degree in Raleigh on Jones Street, but in Congress, they just feel like they are totally immune. They are totally insulated. They are totally incapable of being defeated. And they need to have a wake-up call. I think what happened with Renee Elmers was a good wake-up call. I don't know if anybody paid attention or not. But, you know, you remember she took on Bob Etheridge. And she was a nurse. She wasn't like a political heavyweight. And she came along and got the support of the people in the 2nd District, Tea Party folks, and they supported her, and she won. And then she got to Washington and totally abandoned the principles that she said she had, that people believed in, and voted for her on. So what happens? You know, after 6 years, people said, well, look, we've had enough of this, Renee, and sorry. And next thing you know, she loses in a primary. Now, there's a very good chance, had the courts not nosed into the redistricting maps and jumbled things all around and made the General Assembly rewrite the maps, and suddenly here she was in the same district as another incumbent, George Holding, very good chance that she would have won her primary and probably her general election. But the fact of the matter is, things worked out the way they did, and she suddenly found herself in a big mess when it came to being reelected. And the lesson here is, and I don't know if anybody is listening in Washington to learn the lesson, if they're paying attention to the lesson, but the lesson is you cannot take your seat for granted. You cannot assume that you will always be in that office forever. I know that most of the people in Congress feel that way. They feel privileged and elitist, and they feel like it's their seat for as long as they want it. And in some cases, that's true. You know, there are guys that have been up there for decades. But at least here in North Carolina, maybe other members of Congress will notice what happened in the Renee Elmer situation. And just remember, you know what? I better think about the people that voted for me. I better think about the people that I represent. I better think about the principles that I said that I had when I ran, or that I, you know, roll out every 2 years when I'm trying to get reelected, or run the risk of not being reelected. And, you know, folks, we have more power than we realize, because people in office, they get there one way. They get elected. And if people would wake up and not just, you know, be apathetic and not vote, or just vote a certain way because you voted that way your whole life or whatever, then perhaps the people of Washington would get a clue. The best thing that could happen is if all of the members of Congress were suddenly concerned about losing their seat. There'd be some budget cutting going on, and some principle behind a lot of the votes. But now they just don't care. It's expensive dinners with lobbyists. It's trips. It's glad handing and patting on the back. And this is my seat. And yes, sir, Congressman. And yes, sir, Senator. And yes, ma'am, Mrs. Representative. And on and on and on. And these people have no clue about regular folks like you and me. They have no appreciation for the work that we do and the fact that we actually trust them. And it's like Charlie Brown and Lucy with the football. We keep going to the polls and voting for the same people, and they keep letting us down. And it's like, you know, Lucy talks him into running up and kicking that football, and she jerks it away every time he lands on his head. Well, that's what's happening. How many election cycles is it going to take before we, the voters, say, you know what? We're not falling for your line of nonsense anymore. We're not going to fall for your patriotic conservative diatribes, when in reality your voting record says that you're a liberal and that you have no intention of standing up for the people that you represent. Would be interesting, wouldn't it? Well, we've got a great rest of the show planned for you here. And we've got Tim Boyum of Time Warner Cable News coming up in just a few minutes. And then Dr. Leon Threet, Republican candidate for the 12th Congressional District, running against Alma Adams. And looking forward to both of those conversations. We're going to step aside right now and get your Fox News break after a brief message. And we'll be right back. You're listening to What Matters in North Carolina on the Freedom Action Network.
Fox News Alert, I'm Lisa Brady. The mayor of Dallas says it's time for a change in attitude.
An attitude of humility, of gratitude that this square was built on.
Mayor Mike Rawlings at a prayer vigil in Thanksgiving Square. Police say a gunman who ambushed officers told them he wanted to kill white people. Turns out he had served in the U.S. military. Fox Radio's Eben Brown with more live.
And Lisa, also at that same prayer vigil, the police chief in Dallas, David Brown.
But we are determined to not let this person steal this democracy from us.
Now, this person being the now deceased shooter, Micah Xavier Johnson, he was 25 and from the Dallas area. He had also served in the U.S. Army in the reserves as a combat engineer, even deployed to Afghanistan from late 2013 to summer of 2014, Lisa.
Well, Eben, the White House says no links to any terrorist organizations have been found in the attack that killed five officers, wounding seven more and two civilians. President Obama ordering flags at half-staff after condemning the ambush as despicable during a NATO summit in Poland. Attorney General Loretta Lynch.
To all Americans, I ask you, I implore you, do not let this week precipitate a new normal in this country. I ask you to turn to each other not against each other, as we move forward.
Lynch offering condolences for Dallas and to the families of the two black men shot and killed by police in Louisiana and Minnesota this week. Investigators in Tennessee now say the man who opened fire at a Days Inn yesterday, also targeting cars on a nearby highway, was troubled by recent police shootings. The suspect remains hospitalized, shot as arriving officers returned fire. An officer is one of three others wounded. That attack killed a newspaper carrier. An hour to the close on Wall Street, the Dow up 254. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Real experience, real insight.
We're following this explosive story.
Nothing gets by Greta. Then
this is all BS. What was that all about?
There's no spin and no question. O'Reilly dominates. Plus, smart, sharp, and cutting edge.
It's the news of the day, but with a little heat.
Megan delivers, and Sean seals the deal with fearless talk.
What part of that are you understanding?
Most watched, most trusted Fox News Channel. There's more to Fox News Radio than meets the ear. Go behind the headlines and join the conversation on the hottest stories of the day on the Fox News Radio Facebook page. Be a part of the Fox News Radio Facebook fan community. Post comment and tell us your opinions. See behind-the-scenes photos and videos and post your reactions to the stories that matter to you. Click the like button on Facebook and connect with breaking news and features like Fox in the Fast Lane, House Call for Help, and more. Go to Facebook.com/Fox News Radio.
A suspect in custody for deadly attacks on the homeless in San Diego. Fox Radio's Jessica Rosenthal has this live.
Lisa, San Diego police arrested a 36-year-old man for murdering two homeless people and injuring two others.
My name is Anthony Padgett. We are innocent.
But a man with the same name, whose age matches, was convicted 6 years ago of attacking a homeless acquaintance and setting him on fire. Of the two homeless men killed and two injured just this past week, two of them were also set on fire as well.
We're going to still consider those other attacks that have been happening over the past few weeks. We need to determine if Mr. Padgett is involved or if we either still have another suspect out there.
And Captain David Nislight says they still have a lot of work to do, witnesses to even locate and evidence to process in this case, Lisa.
Thanks, Jessica. A new federal lawsuit by 10 states against the federal government over the president's recent directive to public schools to allow transgender choice in bathrooms and locker rooms. Some pro sports leagues might soon get more social.
Twitter is in talks with several pro leagues and broadcasters about streaming live sports. According to tech website Recode, the NBA, Major League Soccer, and Turner, the parent company of TNT, are among those the social media platform is negotiating with in its bid to acquire digital content rights. Twitter already has a deal with the NFL, paying $10 million last year to live stream some Thursday night games. The company is also reportedly exploring fringe coverage, like it has done with Wimbledon this year, providing pre- and post-match material, while another company has the actual match streaming rights. Chris Onig, Fox News.
Recapping the big rally underway on Wall Street, the Dow is up 250 points, topping 18,100. It's at pre-Brexit levels. Oil prices inching higher, but still near $45 a barrel. It's a rally over the June jobs report. More jobs than expected created, 287,000. Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. Happy Friday to you. My name is Mark Scheiber. Glad to have you listening today and remind you that you can follow us on Twitter at What Matters NC. And you can hit me up at Mark Scheiber. We'd love to engage with you in social media. Now, the General Assembly has cleared the dust. The guys have gone home, and there are some people that are probably very happy about that. And one of them could possibly, we'll ask him if he's happy, is Tim Boyum. And, of course, he's your host of Capital Tonight on the Time Warner Cable News Network. Tim, welcome back.
Okay, thanks for having me. Good to talk with you.
So are you glad they're gone, or do you miss them already?
Well, you know, in an off year, perhaps we would miss them already, looking for more news to cover. But there's been a few things going on in 2016 that we'll have plenty to cover. So, you know, with the more than enough theory, I guess we can't be too upset that they're gone for the year.
Well, Tim, there were 2,053 bills filed, and I thought today we'd just go through each one of them one at a time.
You must have a long show.
Yeah, sometimes it feels like that you have to read all of them. There, that's pretty amazing, though, that out of 2,053 bills, there were 370, which is still a lot, session laws. But that basically means that a little over 80%, almost 90%, didn't make the cut, you know? And so...
Yeah, it would be interesting to see analysis on that if someone ever did, though, because I'd be willing to bet that some of them are other bills that are very similar but just have a few things different.
Right.
Democrats probably have their own bill of Republican bills. And then, of course, a lot of those bills are probably local bills where, you know, a lot of local representatives are filing them to help constituents, even perhaps if they have no chance of passing. So it'd be interesting to see an analysis done on that sometime. We have a lot of great universities around here. Maybe they want to pick that up.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to do it, but maybe somebody else can, and we can certainly talk about it. Our guest, Tim Boyum, here. Governor still has quite a few bills on his desk, but we're not expecting him to veto anything, are we?
Not that I'm aware of, and honestly, most of that, what he was upset about or was happy about, we know about. So I think it's going to be a fairly ceremonious end to him signing bills at the end of the session. I guess you never do know, but there's not an abortion bill hanging out there, you know, something like that, especially in an election year, that we'd be hanging on to see if he'd sign or not. So I think it's going to be a pretty quiet end of that part of the.
Now, Tim, 7 retiring senators, 13 in the House. Do you think, even though the faces will be different next time, do you think that the game will still be the same pretty much because of leadership, particularly in the House? Well, there are some House and Senate leadership changes, but basically at the very top, there's nothing going to change. Do you think that things will remain the same with just different names in different seats?
I don't know. I think that remains to be seen. You know, with Apodaca and Russo both leaving the Senate, they're not only high-level positions, but they're high-level personalities. And, you know, they were, you know, Tom Apodaca was known as the bulldog. I mean, they were arm twisters, and they were true believers. And you know, they have people in Harry Brown and some of the others over there that they think can fill the roles. But I'll be curious to see if you know, the House doesn't try to push a little harder against that, perhaps, or if the Senate personality changes a little bit. And don't forget, there are some House members that have very tough elections that are in high positions in the House as well. So I do think one thing we could see is a little bit slower start to session next year as they start to kind of feel each other out with all these new positions and what happens. Now, this is a long session, so they have time to do that, but I'm not certain. I think we'll there's still a TBD next to that.
Yeah, exactly. Our guest, Tim Boyum, and excellent anchor of Time Warner Cable News. Now, you're exactly right. I mean, Apodaca was certainly larger than life in many respects, and it's very early. It's actually way too early. But is there any speculation that you have heard around Jones Street when you were down there at the end of the session as to who might fill those very big shoes?
Not at the end of session, but there's been discussion, frankly, there was all session with people behind the scenes. I mean, first of all, I wouldn't be surprised by anything. I can't be surprised by anything anymore. The legislature after covering the last 10, 14 years. I don't think people would be surprised if perhaps Harry Brown moved into the rules position of Tom Apodaca. You know, Brent Jackson could possibly move into the head budget role. You know, who then moves into to finance, who knows still. I mean, so I think we'll just see. There's a possibility that we see sort of people just shift into positions and move up one slot, so to speak. But you never know. You know, Senator Berger has his vision, and his chief of staff is very well known down there as well. And so I think we could be surprised, but I think it'll be the faces that we expect. Just imagine, it just is a question of where do the puzzle pieces fit best for them as they try to move forward their agenda in 2017 and 2018.
Yeah, exactly. The problem I've had with playing, you know, move the committee chairs is that Harry Brown, obviously Senator from Onslow and Jones counties, he really does such a good job with the budget for the Senate that moving him over – to rules, you know, then you got to say, well, who's going to take his place? And then you move somebody else to appropriations, and then, well, who's going to take their place? And so it goes on, and it really will be interesting to see what kind of decisions that Senator Berger makes in that regard.
Well, I do think the other question, too, is how the House would respond. I don't know behind the scenes. Of course, the other thing we can't underestimate in that decision-making is ambitions of individuals and meetings that they might have with leadership about trying to convince them to go in a different direction. But I do think, and I don't know the answer to this, but I do think it's going to be interesting to see how the House responds to different leadership. I don't think there's any question people have a challenge trying to convince or change the mind of Tom Apodaca and a Bob Rucho. Do they feel more emboldened to challenge the Senate more without those two there? Or does Harry Brown fit that same role? I mean, I think that's going to be sort of the chess match that goes on early. And I anticipate some fairly, assuming the Republicans maintain the supermajorities, I anticipate some pretty big legislation next year. It's a long session. I think we'll see another large tax change next year, some more education reforms, perhaps transportation changes again, because, you know, the demographics continue to change, and the 2018 is going to be a battle again, and they only can hold on to, likely, and even historically, hold on to supermajorities for so long. So I suspect we will have a very active legislature next year.
Our guest is Tim Boyum. Now, over in the House, Skip Stam, after many years stepping down, he was the, the Speaker pro tem, which is largely kind of just a ceremonial title. But who do you think might step in over there? Because I can't really think of anybody that stands out off the top of my head that would replace Representative Stam.
Yeah, I don't know about that, and I think there'll be some young folks that might want to step up into that position. Who knows, maybe John Bell, who's the whip right now, might want to do that. I do think the larger question is who's going to replace his expertise and his knowledge base. Paul Stam is Paul Stam, and everyone knows who he is and what he's like and what he stands for, but he's a lawyer. He's very particular about bills and that they're done right and everything, and that legislation is done the right way. I think it'll be interesting to see who sort of follows in those footsteps. You know, we've had a couple sort of legal experts. And there's a lot of lawyers at the legislature, but people that are really good legal arguers. We lost Rick Glaser, the Democrat, who's now at the Justice Center, and now Paul Stam leaving as well. And you know, those hard legal arguments are what prevent the need for an extensive technical corrections bill at the end of the session early the next year to fix bills. And so I think the larger question is who's going to replace him from that perspective, but also from school vouchers and sort of a moral conservative nature as well. And he was very conservative on a lot of issues. And so I think that's the larger question of who's going to replace that kind of leadership he provided for the Republicans.
Well, one thing is that we won't be hearing about the Magna Carta anymore with Representative Stam being gone, and perhaps the House sessions will be a tad shorter without the lengthy, although very eloquent, diatribes from Representative Glaser.
That's true. That is very true. The other question with Stam is who will, you know, this is a boring topic for a lot of people, but it's important for homeowners that are facing it. He pushed hard for years and years and years in eminent domain. And that constitutional amendment, they kept getting through the House. Well, this year, it got through the Senate, but then there were two other constitutional amendments that the House had issues with. And that bill died at the end of the year. So will someone take on the eminent domain crusade as well? He was down there a long time. He had a lot of experience. And I wouldn't put it past him to come back at some time. I think he just, feels the need to walk away for a little bit.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that, Tim. That was actually my next question. What happened? Because I was talking to Senator Berger Friday before they quit the whole thing for the session. And he said, is this House House Bill 3 going to pass with the constitutional amendments? He said, call your House member. And all of a sudden, we see how in a couple of the committees, they start going back and forth at one another. Did that constitutional amendment bill kind of get caught up in that animus that was taking place between the House and the Senate at the very end? Or do you know what happened to it?
Well, I think there were likely two scenarios of concern about why that never got through. One was that the House had a great concern about the Constitution and about the Taxpayer Rights Act, which was putting in a cap on the income tax. They didn't disagree with the cap. I think there was some concern about limiting it to where they limited it at 5.5%. So I think there was some concern with that. There was also a much larger concern that they grouped all three into one bill, and so they were forced to all vote on three, something as important as constitutional amendments in one bill. And so I think that was a big concern with that as well. On top of that, there was this argument going on about the Asheville election, and Tom Apodaca had the bill through, and I think he thought it was going to fail through, and the House killed it. And I think he was hurt and upset, and they then decided to pretty much go home at that point. And so there just wasn't enough time to fully vet and discuss that issue, and it's just, It ran out of time, and a lot of times at the end of session, that just happens.
Yeah. Well, it certainly was interesting, and what could have been a very unceremonious end to the short session actually kind of left us wanting more, you know.
Well, and that it did simplify the elections a lot. I mean, just imagine putting something on that important, and I'm not saying for better or for worse, but, you know, capping the income tax to 5.5% is a huge change.
Oh, yeah.
And the other ones were, too, eminent domain and the fishing and hunting one. But, you know, that would have not gotten as much attention, perhaps. But, I mean, we have an election that's wild enough. I mean, imagine three constitutional amendments on it as well.
Yeah, I was really surprised at the way that turned out. And our guest is Tim Boyum, who is really... I told somebody the other day, Tim, I could ask you literally anything and you would know the answer because you're just that good. And so now I'm going to ask, if you think that the latest Justice Department, this whole thing with HB2, 60-something companies, it was reported today, 68 companies signing an amicus brief. Or is that amicus? I never pronounce that right. But anyway.
we know what you mean.
Joining a brief to in a lawsuit challenging House Bill 2. Obviously, they tweaked it, but they didn't tweak it a whole lot. Prior to them adjourning, there was all of this hubbub going on, and the governor's meeting with Democrat, and then there was rumors that Attorney General Cooper had told the Democrats, you know, don't do what the governor wants you to do. And there was all this back and forth. And finally, we ended up with a small tweak to House Bill 2. Did that surprise you at all?
You know, that's a really good question. No. No and yes. That'll make it even more worse. No, because I think the governor, you know, the governor really asked for that. That was his biggest concern. That was low-hanging fruit, not to diminish the importance of it for those that believe in it, but it was low-hanging fruit that they could get votes from both sides of the aisle and a larger majority of Republicans. And the governor said he wanted to do that as part of it when he filed that executive order. And so for his campaign, he can say he got that done to tweak HB2. The discussion was interesting, though. I was fascinated by, you know, this video of Democrats marching into the executive mansion when they don't get called on to do anything. And what that really tells you is that they needed the Democrats' vote to get any other part of HB2 changed. And it became clear whether it was Roy Cooper or the others standing strong or some Republicans that desperately did not want to see it change, that it just was not going to happen. I think it also probably became clear that outside of a repeal, I don't think it was going to change the minds of, say, the NBA or other groups that were against it, including businesses. So in that instance, you know, I wasn't really surprised. So, look, this story is fascinating every day that moves forward. I'm not sure what this amicus brief, what the difference of these companies signing on will be, but we'll see. And I expect that we'll hear from the NBA in the coming weeks as well, which that the fallout from that will be fascinating.
Well, you're definitely right. At least it's not something that we have to talk about every day, because the whole bathroom thing on a daily basis was really getting uncomfortable, or at least monotonous, but it's still with us. And I'm sure, as you said, we'll be watching it and talking about it for weeks to come in the future. Our guest is Tim Boy, now the Tom Apodaca, as you remember, put out this bill with five historically black colleges and universities getting low rates of tuition, lowered rates of tuition, and he said he had death threats over the thing, so he pulled the bill. Finally, in the final budget, three of those schools, I believe Western Carolina, Pembroke, and Elizabeth City State, who, by the way, asked to get back in, this was in the budget, and so now there's a lower cost tuition plan for those three colleges. At the end of the day, is this something that you think will be a positive, or is it just something that we're just going to have to wait and see because it's never been done before?
Well, I think it's sort of in the middle of that. I think I look at it as it almost potentially is a pilot program to see, A, how it impacts enrollment. You know, Elizabeth City State needs students, so it'll bring more students in there potentially. There are some concerns that it will cheapen their degree because it'll be seen as less because it's a cheap, you know, cost compared to the university. So will that be the case, or will it become a great value and a great opportunity for kids to get to college who would not normally have had that in the past? And then also the impact of the lower tuition on the overall budget for universities and how these universities can fund themselves moving forward. You know, will they not have money to continue in certain programs? You know, higher education is about to undergo a massive sort of reevaluation, I think, in the future. The costs continue to rise. Community colleges and the new jobs of the future may not require as many four-year degrees. And so I think this is a really an interesting sort of test pilot program to see what could happen in the future. And honestly, it was one of the more interesting discussions of the session. It's just unfortunate it happened so quickly at the end that we didn't have more time to, you know, to flesh it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Our guest here on What Matters in North Carolina, Tim Boyum. Now, Tim, as we get ready to let you go, enjoy your weekend. What's interesting is some of the bills that did not make it through to the end, and I'm going to read a couple of them, and you can tell me the most significant. First, we have the math standards changed, which would have allowed basically what is known now as Common Core math to continue alongside traditional math. We've already talked about the constitutional amendment to lock income tax rates at 5.5%, and we also did not have the bill killing the I-77 tolls. Out of those three, which do you think was the most significant not to get through all the way to the end?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. I would even add reg reform to that list, by the way, because, you know, that's been a massive push for Republicans since they got into office. And for them to not get one through this year, this is one of the few years they've never got one through. That was a shock to me. I'll just sort of go through them. The constitutional amendment, I think the income tax is going below 5.5 in January anyway. I think they're looking at that saying that's something we might be able to take care of next year in a long session. Mm-hmm. But I am a little surprised that you know, each time they move forward, you just never know what the demographics are going to look like for elections. And what if they lose some of their more urban Republicans in the vote? How does that change it? Because constitutional amendments require a different vote. So in some sense, I am surprised because of that. The math standards, there's no question that just didn't have a lot of discussion time. And so I think that they're looking at that as something to look at much closer next year. They're still implementing a lot of other changes that were put forth through that commission. So I wasn't overly surprised that they didn't get that one through because it just didn't seem to get enough attention and enough discussion early on. And what was the third one again? I'm sorry.
Well, we had the math and the constitutional amendment. And then the I-77 tolls.
Oh, yeah, the I-77 toll, and I'm not surprised at all. I think there's a complete split on this one. DOT thinks it should still move forward, and people in Mecklenburg and Iredell, some of them don't. And it frankly was a lot more complicated than people thought. Some people were against the contract, some people are against tolls, and some people were against both. And I just don't think there was enough rallying support. I was told early in the session that they just weren't going to deal with that. And so I frankly was not surprised at the end of the day.
Well, my solution is to stay out of Charlotte as much as possible. So
the great state of Mecklenburg.
Yeah, exactly. I'll tell you, the traffic down there is incredible. One last question. And, you know, I could ask you how to tear apart a carburetor for a 1972 Corvette. And I'm sure you could tell me. I mean, there's nothing that I can throw at you that you just are not expert at. And so you're really the best, Tim. But one last question in terms of, Do you think, just in your gut, the voting laws that were being reviewed by the Court of Appeals, when they heard opening arguments, they were making some, you know, kind of snide comments about what they thought of the law. And that said to me, uh-oh, you know, they might throw all this stuff out. A, do you think they would do that? I mean, we've seen a court not really care about how close it is to an election, you know, to make a decision when they did the court in Greensboro did the redistricting thing. Do you think they would, this close to an election, albeit several months, toss out North Carolina's voting law and throw everything up in the air?
Well, you know, it's an interesting question between the maps and then versus the voting law. That's a tough question. I was surprised that, not surprised, but I was taken aback by how strong some of those comments that you mentioned were. And the ACLU is very confident, which made me question about whether they would uphold the law in the long run. I mean, I think if they think this law is unconstitutional, I don't know how they don't throw them back. But every day we get closer, it seems unlikely that they would, because there has to be so much planning that goes on. Early voting sites have been being picked in counties already. That would obviously change if they had to, you know, change how they do early voting as well. The same is true for the maps on the state level. It just seems like an arbitrary deadline they sort of put in place has already passed as well. It just seems every day that passes, it would be very difficult for them to do that moving forward. But if they believe it's unconstitutional, I don't know how they will to move forward at the same time. If we've learned one thing this year about the court, is you never know, because what we saw happen with our congressional maps, I don't think very many people predicted.
Yeah. Tim, one last question, and I know you probably don't get into a lot of this perhaps maybe on Capitol tonight, but as someone who's a veteran of television, how do you deal with things like what happened last night in Dallas?
It's a challenge. I try to allow my guests to, you know, I was on another show today, actually got on some of the exact same question. I try to keep my emotions and personality and, well, not personality, but opinion so far away from the show. I sometimes tell people I don't even know if I have opinions anymore. But I see myself as sort of an emotional referee. And so my job is to just try to let people speak their mind and allow them to give them their time to speak. And then just make sure that they don't talk over each other and argue and get too over-involved. The issues that are coming about because of what we're seeing in Dallas, Minnesota, Louisiana, you know, Ferguson, all over the country, they're too important for us to not have an open, honest conversation about it in a good way. And that's what Capitol Science is about. So that's always my focus.
Well, you do a better job than 99% of your peers, so you can certainly feel good about that. We are honored to have you once a week here on What Matters in North Carolina. Hope you have a great weekend, and as always, thank you very much.
You're too kind to me. I thank you very much, and thanks for having me on as always. It's an honor.
Good. Thank you, Tim Boyum. Now, just before we go to our news break here, we got about a minute, and I just saw something else. WRAL reporting that a Missouri police officer shot during a traffic stop. Fayetteville police reporting 60 threats against police officers in 6 hours. So, unfortunately, it doesn't seem like the dust has settled. The smoke has not cleared, and we can only hope and pray that cooler heads will prevail. There is a growing sense of anger, and the answer never is the taking of another human life. I mean, that's the answer. It's never, ever, ever taking another human life, but to shoot at police officers as if they were, you know, targets in a gallery is completely inappropriate. And now Fayetteville police getting threats, a Missouri police officer killed. It's certainly time to give pause here in our country. We're going to take a break now for your Fox News and come back and talk to Dr. Leon Threet. You're listening to What Matters in North Carolina on the Freedom Action Network. My name is Mark Shiver. and we will be right back.
Fox News Alerts. I'm Lisa Brady. The mayor of Dallas says it's time for a change in attitude.
An attitude of humility, of gratitude that this square was built on.
Mayor Mike Rawlings at a prayer vigil in Thanksgiving Square. Police say a gunman who ambushed officers told them he wanted to kill white people. Turns out he had served in the U.S. military. Fox Radio's Eben Brown with more live.
Elisa, also at that same prayer vigil, the police chief in Dallas, David Brown.
But we are determined to not let this person steal this democracy from us.
Now, this person being the now deceased shooter, Micah Xavier Johnson, he was 25 and from the Dallas area. He had also served in the U.S. Army in the reserves as a combat engineer, even deployed to Afghanistan from late 2013 to summer of 2014, Lisa.
Well, Eben, the White House says no links to any terrorist organizations have been found in the attack that killed five officers, wounding seven more and two civilians. President Obama ordering flags at half-staff after condemning the ambush as despicable during a NATO summit in Poland. Attorney General Loretta Lynch.
To all Americans, I ask you, I implore you, do not let this week precipitate a new normal in this country. I ask you to turn to each other, not against each other, as we move forward.
Lynch offering condolences for Dallas and to the families of the two black men shot and killed by police in Louisiana and Minnesota this week. Investigators in Tennessee now say the man who opened fire at a Days Inn yesterday, also targeting cars on a nearby highway, was troubled by recent police shootings. The suspect remains hospitalized, shot as arriving officers returned fire. An officer is one of three others wounded. That attack killed a newspaper carrier. An hour to the close on Wall Street, the Dow up 254. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Real experience, real insight.
We're following this explosive story.
Nothing gets by Greta. Then.
This is all BS. What was that all about?
There's no spin and no question. O'Reilly dominates. Plus, smart, sharp, and cutting edge.
It's the news of the day, but with a little heat.
Megan delivers. And Sean seals the deal with fearless talk.
What part of that are you understanding?
Most watched, most trusted, Fox News Channel. There's more to Fox News Radio than meets the ear. Go behind the headlines and join the conversation on the hottest stories of the day on the Fox News Radio Facebook page. Be a part of the Fox News Radio Facebook fan community. Post comments and tell us your opinions. See behind-the-scenes photos and videos and post your reactions to the stories that matter to you. Click the like button on Facebook and connect with breaking news and features like Fox in the Fast Lane, House Call for Help, and more. Go to Facebook.com/Fox News Radio.
A suspect in custody for deadly attacks on the homeless in San Diego. Fox Radio's Jessica Rosenthal has this live.
Lisa, San Diego police arrested a 36-year-old man for murdering two homeless people and injuring two others.
My name is Anthony Padgett. We are innocent.
But a man with the same name, whose age matches, was convicted 6 years ago of attacking a homeless acquaintance and setting him on fire. Of the two homeless men killed and two injured just this past week, two of them were also set on fire as well.
We're going to still consider those other attacks that have been happening over the past few weeks. We need to determine if Mr. Padgett is involved or if we either still have another suspect out there.
And Captain David Nislight says they still have a lot of work to do, witnesses to even locate and evidence to process in this case, Lisa.
Thanks, Jessica. A new federal lawsuit by 10 states against the federal government over the president's recent directive to public schools to allow transgender choice in bathrooms and locker rooms. Some pro sports leagues might soon get more social.
Twitter is in talks with several pro leagues and broadcasters about streaming live sports. According to tech website Recode, the NBA, Major League Soccer, and Turner, the parent company of TNT, are among those the social media platform is negotiating with in its bid to acquire digital content rights. Twitter already has a deal with the NFL, paying $10 million last year to live stream some Thursday night games. The company is also reportedly exploring fringe coverage, like it has done with Wimbledon this year, providing pre- and post-match.
Welcome back. What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening on this Friday. And if you missed any of our previous segments, we started the show today with Chuck Stuber. He is a former FBI special agent and chief investigator with the North Carolina State Board of Elections, currently a candidate for state auditor on the Republican side, talking about Director Comey's words that he reasons he gave and explanation that he gave for not finding anything wrong with what Hillary Clinton did with her email. We talked with John Wynn, assistant editor at Politics NC, on his article about Clinton's Carolina strategy. Always a pleasure to talk with Tim Boyum from Time Warner Cable News. He's the anchor of Capital Tonight, and a great segment with him going over what the General Assembly did and did not do, and now that they have adjourned for the rest of the year. And so we're moving right along, very fast-paced today, and always a pleasure to be able to talk to new folks on what matters in North Carolina. And our guest now is Dr. Leon Threet. He is a Republican candidate for 12th Congressional District seat, running against Congresswoman Alma Adams. And Dr. Threet, welcome to the program.
Well, it's my honor to be on your program today. Thank you for your time. And there's a lot of things happening in our nation and certainly here in our state. So thank you.
Well, there certainly are. And we're having you on today, certainly on the heels of an African-American shot in Louisiana by law enforcement, an African-American shot by law enforcement in Minnesota, multiple white law enforcement officers killed last night in Dallas by a shooter who reportedly has said, "I just wanted to kill some white cops," or something to that effect. And then minutes ago, got an alert here that Fayetteville has received 60 threats. The Fayetteville law enforcement has received 60 threats over the last 6 hours. And now there are reports that a police officer in Missouri has been shot on a routine traffic stop. Dr. Threet, you are a candidate for Congress. If you were in Congress right now and all of this craziness were going on in the matter of 4 or 5 days, what kind of thoughts would you be having, and is there a solution to this sort of thing?
Well, I think there certainly is. First of all, we need strong leadership, and that has been absent for some time. I'm a former Charlotte Mecklenburg police officer, spent 8.5 years walking the beat and serving our community as a police officer. So I understand the world and the requirements of a law enforcement officer, but also I understand what it means to be a citizen. So there are issues that need leadership, and we haven't had that. We haven't seen it to the level that we needed. We have had for 7.5 years a very divisive kind of leadership that seems to somehow pit the public against law enforcement. My son is also a police officer here in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, North Carolina. So, and I have a lot of family and a lot of friends that I'm connected with the law enforcement community. But there's a lot of change that's needed. And this whole divided of our communities against law enforcement against the community needs to be addressed. As a congressman, I certainly would be representing all of our communities. See, we've got to have leadership that knows how to deal with the suburban issues and the urban issues. We need leadership that can voice and speak to the uniqueness of each of our segments of our community, and we haven't had that. We haven't had it in some time. We've had the absence of strong leadership, which gives way and vent to this kind of divisiveness that we've seen in our nation.
Well, our guest is Dr. Leon Threet, who is a candidate, Republican candidate for 12th congressional seat, the district in North Carolina, a district that has been featured nationally for its odd shape. I think it's like 10 feet wide at one point. Is that correct?
It was. The courts required the North Carolina General Assembly to redraw all 13 districts. It did so in January, February, and at the present, the 12th congressional district is solely in Mecklenburg County. So we have a completely new district, and it's all in Mecklenburg County, 780,000 residents, citizens that we represent here in the 12th, and I'm looking forward to serving all of Mecklenburg County.
Well, it would appear to me, and I just think this would make common sense, that, and I've always felt this way, that candidates ought to have to live in their district, but apparently in Congress, congressional elections, that's not the case.
You're right. You're right. Well, it has its pros and cons. If when the districts are constantly redrawn, as we have seen over the years, it would make it very difficult to properly represent your district if it's being redrawn every so many years. But I do think that every representative needs to be able to identify with the citizens that they represent. And the way it was gerrymandered in the past, as of up until January, it covered six counties over a 97-mile radius, and it was snaked up 85 corridor, which wasn't a very good representation of all of the people that it was supposed to represent. So I'm hoping and praying that this new district will be drawn to represent a better representation of all of those in the 12th. And it certainly is it's, you know, diverse to, I think, for the betterment of the entire region. So I'm hoping it will be a better representation.
Now, as I understand it, Alma Adams is the Democrat candidate. She does not live in the district, but she is an incumbent of sorts, at least in having been serving in Congress for a short while prior to yes. this election. So in terms of gun control, I'm just waiting for the president or somebody else to come out and, you know, make a big push for gun control. In fact, the political, you know, blame game has already started.
Right.
And the president and those that believe in gun control would say things like what he said, quote, "We also know that when people are armed with powerful weapons, unfortunately, it makes attacks like these more deadly, more tragic. And in the days ahead, we're going to have to consider those realities as well." So that sounds like a clear, although veiled, but clear, assertion on the part of our president that, you know, the only way to stop this sort of thing is through gun control. I don't agree with that. Where do you come out on that?
Well, I agree with you 100%. When our elected officials or anyone begins to espouse to the thinking that controlling guns or limiting gun usage or access to them somehow is going to solve the hatred that's in the heart of some. You see, it just shows that they don't really understand the problem. The problem is not the gun. Now, my 8.5 years as a police officer here in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg community, I never saw a gun kill a person.
Right.
I saw people kill people with guns. And if they don't have a gun, they have a knife. They don't have a knife, they have a stick. They have some way to hurt one another. The real issues are is the hatred and the divisiveness that's in our communities. Now, grant you accessibility of guns by those who need not to have them, meaning the criminals, the violent ones, we should do everything we can to keep guns out of their hands. But the Second Amendment is about citizens having the right to defend and protect themselves. Police can't be everywhere. Most of the time, police arrive after the events have occurred. And in that interim period, those minutes between the time of a violent assault until the police arrive, most people have been victimized long before the police arrive. And so citizens deserve and must have the right to defend themselves against all intrusion, all violent acts, whether it's foreign or domestic. And I think one of the number one issues, now I know we're dealing with the shootings in our inner cities and throughout our communities right now, but there is a more urgent, just as urgent threat from radical Islam that have made themselves very clear that they've declared war on the West. And the American people must have the right to defend themselves. The 50 or the 49 killed in Orlando, that's just the beginning of a crisis. I think we've seen enough where radical Islam has declared their war against the West. And so the American people must be able to defend themselves. And so limiting weaponry or a means to defend themselves by the American people. That's not the answer. We need to begin to deal with the hatred. We need to begin to build bridges, and it takes leadership to do that. We've got to find answers to the issues that are going on in the lives of people and be able to bring our communities together and problem solve the things that divide us. But taking the guns away from law-abiding citizens is not the answer. My opponent, Congresswoman Adams, believes very strongly that we need gun legislation to limit the use of certain weapons, and she's been in line with the president on this from the very beginning. I don't think that's the answer. I think the guns in the wrong hands, or the guns in the hands of the wrong people, certainly we need to look for ways to verify those people do not have weaponry. But the law-abiding citizens must have a way to defend themselves. And yet at the same time, I'm very concerned about law enforcement who, out of either a failure to understand the communities of color or a fear they have of the communities of color or a lack of training, that they would resort to deadly force when you don't have a deadly force situation. Now, I walk the streets in some of the hardest places here in Charlotte-Mecklenburg. And I don't remember ever having a time where I was so fearful of the public that I felt like deadly force was necessary. And I'm concerned when law enforcement is either so untrained or so fearful of the community of color that they would resort to deadly force so quickly. I think we need to reevaluate and look at those issues. And again, that comes when we understand the people and the communities that we've been charged to serve. So we have some needs on every side. Law enforcement has got to do a better job, and the public at large has got to do a better job.
Well, our guest is Dr. Leon Threed here on What Matters in North Carolina, here on the Freedom Action Network. Now, let me just ask you this, not as a candidate per se, but just as somebody who used to wear the uniform. When you went out on patrol and suddenly you found yourself in a situation that was dangerous, when you look at these guys in these situations, and now with phones and body cameras and dash cameras, we see this stuff in our living rooms. When you look at like the situation that we saw in Louisiana, where I didn't particularly understand why they shot that guy. I wasn't there, but what goes on in a police officer's head during those milliseconds of high adrenaline that take them over the edge? Can you comment on that? Do you understand what's at work there?
I do. You know, every in public encounter has the potential to become something far more violent. But a well-trained police officer uses every means at their disposal. One of the greatest tools a police officer has is their ability to communicate. You talk to the public. The last thing you want to do is put your hands on the public, but you keep talking. When you do have to put your hands on them, you do it in a proper and an effective way that you minimize injury to the person you have to detain, and you minimize the impact that you have of the threat you have on law enforcement. So good communications. You talk to people, and you ask people to comply. You work with the public, But what I saw in that video, it frightened my heart, because here was an unarmed citizen and the police officer took his weapon out when he did not need to take his weapon out. In fact, the last thing you want to do as a police officer is tie your hands up with a weapon when you don't really need to be using deadly force. The time you pull your weapon out is when you feel like or you recognize you have a deadly force situation, and then you prepare yourself. But to pull your weapon out when you're trying to detain the public, your hands are not free. I saw from that video a number of weaknesses or failures in the law enforcement contact. You talk to the public. You ask them to comply. While you're talking to them, you're talking to them about submitting and complying. I'm putting handcuffs on you. Please, you know, you get the man's name. If you know his name, Mr. Wilson, will you please comply? So don't make this difficult. I'm going to put the handcuffs on you for my safety and your safety. And you talk to the public. And it was just a real failure on the law enforcement. There was two officers, at least I saw two officers. So there's no need for deadly force. When you have two officers there able to detain, it did not appear that the suspect or the young man was was resisting, at least not in a terrible sense. He was on his face. He wasn't able to run. He's not able to really fight. He's on his face. Just a real failure on the law enforcement standpoint. It was very tragic and heartbreaking. And that's what we've got to require police officers to be better trained and better able to work with the public.
Well, let me interrupt to ask you this. I mean, obviously, law enforcement people go through extensive training. You're saying they need to be better trained, but I mean, that just didn't, you know, and I don't, you know, obviously, these guys are probably going to be adjudicated in some form or fashion, and we'll have to get all of the facts before we can really understand and make any effort at passing judgment. But shouldn't they have already been trained well enough to, I mean, what would compel someone to shoot somebody in that situation? I just don't get it.
I agree with you. You need to be, every officer needs to be so well trained before they put that uniform on, that badge, and carry that gun, because we trust the public and we want to somehow reinstill a great confidence that the public should have in law enforcement, that we can trust them. And that, you know, one of the statements in the communities of color is the danger of driving while black. And though I'm a prior police officer and I'm very pro-police, that language is being communicated that there is a danger from the police more so than from the general public. Now, we know that's not true, but because police have been charged to protect the public, and then at times like this, we see the very police taking advantage or victimizing the public. We've got to solve those issues. And I must admit, and I do say, the vast majority of police officers are very well trained, very respectful to the public, and they do a wonderful job defending and serving the community. But when you have these few individuals, either out of a failure to understand their duties and responsibilities to serve and protect all of the public, or they're just fearful. It appears that there's a growing segment of the law enforcement community that are fearful of black males in the community, so much so that they are overreacting and using deadly force or excessive force when there is no need to. And so we've got to address that issue. And certainly I'm first in line to say that the black community or the community of color has got to do a much better job communicating respect and regard for law enforcement and to all of those in authority. We certainly must have that. But at the same time, we expect law enforcement to give due respect to all of the citizens, treating the public as it should treat them. And yes, communities of color deserve that same kind of respect. It's a real challenge because, see, part of the challenge is that there is a legal right in North Carolina to carry a weapon. Now, I happen to be a legal carrier of a concealed weapon. And I'm concerned as a legal carrier of a concealed weapon that if I'm meeting one of these police officers who are fearful of me and overreact because I'm a legal carrier of a weapon, or if you know, just the scenario is quite dangerous. And so we need the public to be patient and calm with law enforcement, but we need the law enforcement to understand that it's not a crime in North Carolina to have a gun. It's not a crime to carry it concealed if you are, in fact, a legal carrier of a concealed weapon. And so we need the police and the public to look at this thing properly. And so we should expect a lot from law enforcement because a lot has been given. And so we expect them to respect the public in the highest level of respect.
Absolutely. Our guest is Dr. Leon Threet. He is a Republican candidate for the 12th Congressional District, and he is a veteran of law enforcement experience. We have been assaulted in North Carolina by those who would, in the name of inclusion and diversity, violate the privacy rights of women and young girls by saying that it's okay for men to be in the restrooms, locker rooms, showers, etc., of females. And today we were treated to a news article that said that 68 companies have signed on to brief to the lawsuit that is being filed, asking the Justice Department or the court to overturn North Carolina's House Bill 2. Where do you come in on House Bill 2? Do you think it was good legislation? Do you think that it was bad legislation? What are your thoughts there?
Well, I was one of the leaders in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg area that stood against the overreach of the city council here in our city that started the city ordinance that authorized men to be in girls' restrooms and locker rooms. And when the governor and the legislators, actually in request of many of us who live in this region, when they passed House Bill 2, we believe that it was a common sense piece of legislation, and it made right the wrongs of the city council here in Charlotte, Mecklenburg. I don't really understand how anyone with any sense of decency could not get behind House Bill 2. It's a shame to think we've come to a place in our society where we would think having men and boys in restrooms, in showers, in locker rooms is appropriate. Now, I have a 15-year-old daughter, I have a 7-year-old granddaughter, and I assure you, as a common sense father and grandfather, I will not sit quietly by while my children and grandchildren or any of the other children in our state are being victimized by this kind of overreach of government. And yes, if the president so chooses to try to press this, if the business community thinks they want to press this, then I would like to think that common sense citizens of North Carolina would stand our ground and say, this is common sense. We just don't do this. And to see our Mecklenburg County school board and the superintendent of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg schools in defiance to the law, House Bill 2 is the law of North Carolina. And for them to come out in the last few weeks to say, well, we're going to institute transgender bathrooms and showers in all of our public schools in defiance to the governor and to the laws of North Carolina, to the law of North Carolina, I just think that was totally inappropriate, and it's actually illegal. And I would like to think that our sheriff's department and the law enforcement officers here in our county would enforce the law of House Bill 2. We will stand, and whether businesses will stand with us or not, I don't know, but we, the citizens of North Carolina, must stand on common sense legislation, common sense behavior, and to have boys and girls in the restroom is just unimaginable. Boys and girls showering together, it's just unacceptable. It will not happen. It just cannot happen. We cannot sit quietly by while this kind of governmental overreach takes place in our great state. North Carolina is a great place to raise a family. It's a great place to educate our children. It's a great place to serve and to do what is proper. And I just cannot imagine that we're permitting these kind of things happening in our state.
Well, I certainly do agree with you there, Dr. Threat. Your website is Leon Threat, and that's spelled THREATT.com. It's been a pleasure. Unfortunately, we've run out of time. I'd love to have you back again as a guest and talk some more about things that you apparently are very well versed in, and love to get your insight on some other issues. Unfortunately, we're out of time. But thank you very much for joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yes, sir. Well, I hope you have a great weekend. And once again, it's leonthreat.com. Well, we are at the end of another show, and we appreciate you listening. You can go to freedomactionnetwork.com and listen to the show anytime as a podcast. You can download it there. Send the website link to your friends and family members. Tell them about the show. You can also find us in the iTunes and Google Play stores as well. We look forward to talking to you again on Monday. Until then, hope you have a great weekend. Bye.
Can't you see the sunshine? Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine? You hit me from behind. Yes, I'm gone to Carolina in my mind. Gone
Can't you just feel the moonshine? Ain't it just like a friend of mine? You hit me from behind. Yes, I'm gone to